All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
This is Sugar Steve. On this week's QLS Classic, we revisit the July 11th, 2018 episode with Jeffrey Osborne. He recalls his time with LTD, making hits on his own, and playing on Soul Train. I also get to tell him which song of his changed my formative years. Questlove ain't the only one who gets to meet his heroes. Episode 92 of Questlove Supreme. Enjoy.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Hey, it's all right with me.
Yeah.
No matter what you want to believe.
Yeah.
Half of Supreme Team's here.
Yeah.
More for me and Steve.
Roll call. Suprema,
and Bill too.
Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
What's it all about?
Yeah.
Roll call.
Yeah.
Or roll out.
Roll call.
Suprema. I'll explain later.
Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My shoelaces.
Yeah.
Have slowly loosened.
Yeah.
Please forgive me.
Yeah.
I'm only human.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is J.O.
Yeah.
Some call me Jeffrey.
Yeah.
Some call me Osborne.
Yeah.
Hey, what's left of me?
Roll call. Hey. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Oh, wait, before I do anything,
yes,
I'm breaking tradition.
Okay.
I'm asking a question first, then I'll introduce our guest.
Okay.
Jeffrey Osborne.
You just introduced our guest.
Is that you drumming for Smokey Robinson on Soul Train in 1974?
With the part down the middle of my head?
That is you! Ladies and gentlemen,
that is me.
Welcome. I knew it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme. I am Questlove, and our Supreme team consisting of...
This is team today, yeah, not Supreme. Team. Yeah,
yeah. Sugar Steve, who's very excited, I think, more than anyone, wanted this episode to go down.
Yes.
Sugar Steve. And, of course, Boss Bill with us. Not with us. Fonticolo is still waiting on his tiles for his basement house furnishing. Laia somewhere getting her house together in Los Angeles.
Did you know that Fonte did an audiobook recently?
No.
I didn't know that. Apparently he narrated a children's book. It's called the title is great. The title is called We Used to Have Money, Now We Have You.
You have some explaining to do, Fonte, and unpaid bills somewhere on Sesame Street. Yeah, Sesame Street land. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so excited about our guest today that I did absolutely no prep work whatsoever because I think I can just go off the top of the dome. One of my personal, in my top five soul singers ever. I haven't been this happy for Steve. I mean, he means much more, even more than me. Then Steve is mad at me already for putting him on the spot.
No,
like that.
No.
I know. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jeffrey Osborne to Questlove Supreme.
All right.
We've been trying to make this happen for a second. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's great, man. I'm enjoying it. I even got started and I'm enjoying it.
Trust me, this is Black Music Nerd Paradise.
Yes, yes. Oh, really?
And Steve.
Well, I'm a
nerd.
Well,
that's where the nerd came in, huh?
Yeah. My first question is always, where were you born?
In Providence, Rhode Island.
Really?
Providence, Rhode Island. Yeah. Youngest of 12. Oh,
wow. Really?
That's a really. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a situation where someone wasn't born down south or in the Midwest.
Yeah.
You're probably our first Northeast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was interesting growing up there. Not a lot of Black people. I think my family probably represented the most Black people in Rhode Island.
Really?
No, but there's not a lot. So it was kind of shocking when I met LTD because they told me there was a 10-piece Black band playing downtown. I'm like, I ain't seen
10
Black musicians together in a while in Providence. So that was kind of interesting.
They started in Providence?
No, they were actually Sam and Dave's backup band. Oh. Back when Sam and Dave were rolling during the Hold On, I'm Coming days, Soul Man days, they were called Soul Men LTD, Soul Men Limited. And they left them in the early, around 69, and they were based in North Carolina. So they started coming up the East Coast playing in the clubs, and I met them in a little nightclub in my hometown of Providence, Rhode Island, believe it or not.
So was it a musical family?
My family?
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a bit. I'd say eight of the 12 of us were into music, either played instruments or sang. My father was a great trumpet player, and, you know, he was one of those guys that never went after his dream, but, you know, anytime any of the big bands came through town, like Ellington and Basie, he would run down and play trumpet with them, and he was a pretty amazing trumpet player, but he had 12 kids. That's what you get for having 12 damn kids. I don't even know how you have 12 kids. You couldn't do it today.
Yeah.
Back then, it was, you know, it was a lot of big families back then.
Oh, okay.
So he just worked a few jobs, you know, during the day and played at night in the clubs. And
was
well known.
What was the main industry in Rhode Island?
Costume jewelry. Still is, you know.
Really?
Yeah, especially in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Huge costume jewelry place, yeah.
So similar to people moving to Detroit for cars or factories in the Midwest.
Right.
Costume jewelry, like the epicenter is in...
Yeah, it was in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, right.
The more you know.
Right.
Wow, that's crazy. So, leading back to my original question, can I assume that drums was your weapon of choice first, or how did you...
Singing was my weapon of choice first. I started singing in nightclubs when I was 13. My mother used to chaperone me, and I would go... My first job was in New London, Connecticut, a little club called Ebony Lounge. I was 13. I thought I was doing big shit back then. I was making $10 a night. But, you know, that was way back then. And I started playing drums when I was about 15. My brother, Billy, who was a drummer, left a set in the basement, you know. And so I kind of was a self-taught drummer. Okay. But everything that's happened for me has happened through drumming. Like when I met LTD, their drummer had gotten locked up that night I went to see him for smoking weed. In 1970, that was like a major offense. Now everybody got a marijuana card.
Right.
You know, it don't mean nothing today, but they locked him up and I sat in, played drums with him, sang a couple of songs, and they asked me to join the group.
So you winged your first gig with LTD, not knowing?
Yeah, but they were doing top 40. And I used to work part-time in the record store, so I kind of knew everything that was out then. So it was kind of easy. And I was playing locally, my band. So I sat in with them and, you know, sang a couple of songs. And I don't know, that guy was in jail for a while. So. And then the funny thing, when I was 15, I met the OJs in a club in Providence. So I went to see them perform. Mm-hmm. And when they had a drummer. And back then, you know, the drum of passion was heroin. You know, that's what a lot of our black musicians got hung up into back in the day. Mm-hmm. And so he was nodding out in between songs. And I'm watching him and I'm like, damn, this dude was falling asleep in between songs. So club owner let me meet them. I talked to Eddie. I was like, you need a drummer. They said, okay, well, if you can find us one because you're too young. I'm like, no, I can play. No, I said, okay. So I brought about three drummers up and I auditioned. And I got the job. So I played with them for 2 weeks while they were in Providence. And so I kind of owe my career to drugs.
Drugs and drums.
But again, drumming is, you know, what opened the door for all of that.
I see. See? Yeah. Drumming opens the door.
There you go.
To an industry. Wait, what year was the, was it before?
It was 1970.
All right, before they made their In Philadelphia record a year later.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They had five people in the group. There was five singers there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That lineup. So you're saying that before your nightclub hopping, you didn't have like a high school band experience or any?
Not a high school band experience, but I played with a lot of the, you know, the musicians that I played with were all from the same high school. We played together, but I was the only black one. But yeah, but I did play with a lot of musicians that were working their way through Berklee School of Music in Boston. So that was nice because I got a chance to play with some really good musicians back then.
Oh, so you even had to learn repertoire for rock music and
yeah, I was playing nightclubs, but it was actually, the funny thing, it was in the ghetto. It was a hood. There was a hood in Providence. Mm-hmm. So I was basically doing mostly R&B music, you know. But I grew up listening to jazz because my whole family was into jazz. I'm the youngest of 12, and I'm 70 years old. So everybody was listening to Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald and Billy Eckstein and Joe Williams. And my dad was into Miles Davis. But his favorite trumpet player, obviously, was Clifford Brown. So I got a chance to listen to everything, you know. Back in when I started, I was singing a couple jazz songs, you know, and R&B, you know, kind of mixed it up. But I didn't not a lot of rock. Wasn't into rock.
Who were your influences as far as vocal?
Back then?
Yeah.
My biggest influence, which everybody finds strange, was a singer named Gloria Lynn. Oh, Gloria Lynn was actually my biggest influence. I didn't realize that till down the line, and I went back and started listening to Gloria Lynn records, and I'm like, damn. I phrased a lot of things like her. I guess subconsciously I was kind of really into her. But, you know, Sarah was my favorite. I loved Sarah Vaughan. I loved, I loved all the jazz singers. And then, of course, coming up, there was the regulars, the Donny Hathaways, the Marvin Gayes, you know, those people I loved. And, Stevie was singing back then, you know, at 13 years old, I was still trying to sing fingertips. And my voice was that high back then. And my mm-hmm. voice dropped from male soprano to bass from junior high school to high school. Wow. One semester. It's crazy.
So when did LTD officially start or as a group? Or even at that time, you're freelancing as a drummer and
right
in the group at the same time?
Well, we took a trip to L.A., and they were actually from Rhode Island. We drove to L.A. with a big U-Haul trailer on the back of the car, and that broke off and snapped the bumper and rolled down a mountain in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Wait, what?
So, yeah, I mean, we were driving through Flagstaff. People don't realize it snows in Flagstaff, Arizona, so it was going up a little hill, and it was icy, and the car just started skidding, and the trailer snapped off, rolled down the hill. So we had to get someone to go down and pull it back up, and we were there for a couple of days trying to get the bumper repaired. And so we drove out to L.A. in 1970, and we played in every nightclub in L.A. for no money. It was the price of admission.
Really?
It was 10 of us living in a one-bedroom house. Wow. And we played for the admission, and which fee was back then was $2 a head to get in. So, you know, if we got 40 people in the nightclub, we had $80 to split 10 ways. I was sending home for money. My parents was like saying, don't you think it might be time to come back home? My right. older brother was like, I was like, dude, just send me the money.
It's an investment.
I don't want to hear this lecture right now.
I do want to ask, how is it or was it feasible? Because, you know, the 70s had super groups.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I mean, I was in the 90s in a band of four members. We were struggling.
Oh, yeah.
And so I, you know, used to wonder, like, well, what was the system like for bands in the 70s that were 10, 11, 12, 13 strong? You all had costumes. You all had all these elements. Was per diem a thing back then in the day?
Oh, like, I didn't even know what per diem was until I became a solo artist.
And then you had to pay it out of your pocket.
Right. That's when I had to pay it to other musicians. Right. That's when I realized, oh, this is per diem. I got to pay this. But no, yeah, there was no per diem back then. I mean, we were struggling just to get by and pay the rent. You know, what you got to look at it for what it is. I mean, even when we became a hit group in the 72 was our first record. Mm-hmm. So it took us a couple of years to get rolling, you know. And then even when we were popular, you split anything 10 ways, that ain't nothing. You can take $1 million, split it 10 ways, that ain't nothing.
It still ain't
you
nothing, know, right.
So, yeah, it's rough for those groups back then. A lot of them, you don't realize the struggle that they went through. And then again, then you got, you know, people's personalities clashing, and mm-hmm. this one wants to do this, and that one wants to do that, and there's always a struggle. It's tough. So I admire the groups that came out of that era, you know.
So even before you were scheduled to do this show, I found a record on Sunday. I didn't realize that there was a your first record on A&M, and there was a woman in the group as well.
Oh, yeah, Celeste. Her name was Celeste, yeah.
So was she always in the group in the beginning, or?
No. There was a girl named Tammy Starr in the group when I joined the group, and you know, there was, you know, a lot of people that went through that group. We had a baritone sax player, we had a percussionist, and times got hard, and they dropped out before we even got the record going, you know.
Ooh,
so.
I know they were salty.
Yeah, they're a little upset now. But, you know, it happens like that. You know, it's hard to make that struggle and give up everything. So she was with us for one record.
Okay. What was the audition process like, and how many other labels were you guys gunning for? Or how did you even gain the attention?
Well, we actually got our first deal through a production deal that Jerry Butler had on A&M Records.
Jerry Butler always finds
he's always popping up in these stories.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Leon Silver, everyone has a Jerry Butler connection. Yeah. So he had a production company?
He had a production company. So we signed to his production company. And after our first record, the label then came over and signed us directly to the label, even though we didn't do any sales on the first record. I couldn't figure that out. But they signed us directly to the label after the first record.
What do you think it was that?
I think back then it was so different than it is today, because they had artist development departments. So they could see us live. They watched the potential, and they said, 3 years down the line, we know what you could be. That don't happen anymore today. And so they invested in developing us, and, you know, they went out, they found producers, and that's why music is so different today. Today, man, I mean, we used to get a piano vocal, and we'd be able to hear what this song could be, and record companies could. Today, you got to give them a fully produced product, and they still can't hear what it's supposed to be. It's crazy.
Wow. So when you nabbed that record deal, was there suddenly dreams and hopes of, like, okay, we made it big time? And what were those early struggle days like?
Well, it was, you know, what we did first with it with the A&M was we played behind a couple of their artists. So we played behind Mary Clayton, mm-hmm. and we did all her live shows, and we had this one show was at the Monterey Folk Festival. Mm-hmm. I guess it was 1971, end of 1971. And somebody fell out, so they asked us to do a 20-minute set. and we did a 20-minute set. And it was like 80,000 people, and they went crazy. That's when the record company said, okay, we see what you can be now. So it was, you know, it was a grind, but we were doing all original material, and it was a lot of it was social protest material back then. So we were kind of turning people on and turning people off.
Did that seem like, so was it Alpert? Did you guys have a relationship with Alpert or Moss at the time when you?
Not really. Nah, the first year we didn't, we were trying to form a relationship, but Jerry was our guy, Jerry Moss. I mean, Herb Albert was the music guy, you know, because he was off doing his thing. But Jerry Moss is the one that really believed in us. And you know, he put the support behind us.
Okay. See, yeah, at the time I thought that the Getting Down album, I thought that was the first album. I didn't realize that.
There was one before that.
Yeah,
there
was the one
just
before.
It's just called LTD. Really, a real forgettable record.
Well, you know.
Getting Down was kind of forgettable, too. But, you know, it was the struggle was it was everybody wanted to sing. So if you listen to those early albums, there's about four different lead singers on
exactly.
the record. And so
like I thought you were just the drummer of the group and yes. didn't figure out.
So this is where the company came in and you know, the third record, they said, okay, you know, this is your third record we're invested in. We now have to zero in on a voice. There's too many lead singers and we think he should do the majority of the vocals.
How was that?
I don't think that still sits well with them.
Oh, wow. Wait, to this day?
To this day, yeah, because they feel that if everybody had a chance to sing when I left, they would still be viable. So I get that, you know. If it wasn't for the producer giving you all the damn songs, and you know, when you left, we'd have been straight. I'm like, well, maybe y'all should have had a hit with some of the songs you sang.
I wasn't mad at cutting it up. That was... No, that became a hip hop staple. It was different because all this time I thought it was P-Funk related. I didn't realize it was LTD. But who was managing you guys at the time?
Back then it was a guy named Ron Nadell.
Okay,
he was one of our first managers. And
so in a situation like that, at least with 10 people, like who's the alpha figure that.
There was
breaks up fights.
It was an alpha figure when I first joined the group. His name was Onion. He had a bald
was he
head.
Bald-head?
Bald-headed.
I know it. Well,
Onion was the guy. He was the leader. And after I was in the group for about a year and a half, my brother Billy came in the group.
Okay.
And he's an alpha. So they clashed. So,
whoa.
You know, it was like, okay, I want to run it this way. I want to run it this way. And so I'm sitting in the middle. Because I was doing most of the work and the lead singing, so it's like, who am I going to side with? So that got old with me. I had to side with somebody, you know. And but there were two. There were two that really wanted to control the group, and the group was just set up wrong, you know. And you know, which is good when you see the way groups are set up today. It's a lot better for the individuals to actually evolve. Mm-hmm. Back then, you know, we had this songwriters agreement that for some stupid reason I signed. And so when I was ready to leave the group, I was still signed to this songwriters agreement. And then they didn't want to give me a solo record because A&M came to me and said, we want to give you a solo project. And they're like, no, he can't do the solo project. He's exclusive with us. There were people that wanted me to write songs. No, exclusive songwriter agreement with us. So it got stifling to the point where I really couldn't evolve if I wanted to. And, you know, so I, in 1979, I told them I wanted to leave the group. And then I stayed on another year just to make it easier for them to find someone. And then I did the next tour. And that was in 79. That was the tour we did with the Jacksons.
Yeah.
And that was the last tour. And then I think I did one more tour. But then when I got ready to leave the group in 1980, it got kind of ugly. That's why there's never been a reunion. You know, everybody's like, how come there's no LTD reunion? Well,
even
it's just the way that we split up. It wasn't an amicable split, right?
Yo, what's up? This is Fonsigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
What was it like working with the Mizell brothers? Who
was interesting?
They produced the
Blackbirds,
Love to the World record.
Yeah. Yeah, they produced Love to the World record. They were interesting. They were good because they had, they brought in some very good people as far as orchestrating things. You know, I think Love Ballad was orchestrated so well back then, and but you know, we did well with them. The funny story with them is that I think I sang the lead vocal on Love Ballad at 5 o'clock in the morning after I sat and waited for them to show up. And I was so pissed off, I did one take and left, and that was it.
Oh, wow.
I'm there at like 9:30, 10 o'clock. I'm all pumped, ready to sing. No show. I think they showed up about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And so we had this big round table discussion. I'm like, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Just sing this song one time. Just try it. I'm like, all right. So I sang it. One take.
That's the Alpha.
That was it.
That's the infamous Quincy Jones.
Oh, it was the Alpha State.
Yeah, yeah. Quincy Jones has a theory that, for a lot of the music, he would choose to record, when he was making The Dude, choose to record his musicians at those ungodly hours.
Right.
Because he says that if you're fully aware, you'll tend to overthink your performance in the studio.
Right.
Whereas if you're just tired, you just do the matter at hand without putting a second thought into it.
And well, that might work for musicians, but if you're tired as a singer.
No, but you can't. Yeah, so you're saying when you listen to Love Ballad, like you're like, ah, I was pitchy on the part, or I should have.
No, I was, for me, for the most part of my career, my first takes were always my best take. Always, you know, and I would always go back and do another take, and it was like I was trying to sing like myself now. I'm trying to, you know. But the first impression was always the right impression. So I'm a big believer in that, you know.
So rarely if you worked with a producer, it's just like...
Oh, yeah.
Take 17.
One time.
George Duke?
No, I love George Duke.
Oh, who?
He was... George Duke was... Oh, man, I was so close with George. Richard Perry. Richard Perry, who had all these hits with the Pointer Sisters. And
Which album did he produce?
He produced the Emotional album with the Woo Woo song on it.
Okay. And Soweto, right?
And Soweto, right.
Yeah, that was my joint.
But I pulled it from him after a certain point and took it. So we're not friends to this day. But he, I was like, take 24. And I'm like, dude, I sang this song 20 times. You have it. But he never knew what he had. He had to sit up and listen to this take and this take and then piece all this together. And I'm like, man, that ain't even real. So we, you know, after a while, I was like, I got to get away. So and that was a A&M Records decision, because that was the first record I did without George. He did my first three solo records.
Okay.
And then here comes Richard Perry. And it was like, you know, George was a dream. He was, to me, the best producer I've ever worked with as far as knowing how to work with a vocalist, because most of the other producers were kind of intimidated and didn't know what to tell me to do. Mm-hmm. But George was, I mean, the dude, he's scary. He had like perfect pitch. He says he's on that perfect, but he had perfect pitch. And he would just make suggestions that were so right on, you know, and I was like, yeah, George, that's pretty cool. That works, you know. So I had a great relationship with George, but Richard was a different guy. You know, it was back in the day when people were doing things that they shouldn't be doing in the booth. And he never knew when he had it. And it was like that with the musicians also. It just was take after take after take after take. So he was the one guy that I've never had that experience with any other producer.
How did you guys even get a Love Ballad? With Skip Scarborough wrote it.
Skip Scarborough wrote it, and
did he have a relationship with you guys, or was it just like, hey, no. I got a song? And
I think Mizell's knew him.
Okay.
And Maurice passed on it. Maurice White passed on it. Gave it to him first.
Oops.
I'm trying to imagine that.
Yeah, I think it probably didn't work for him, you know.
I can kind of hear it.
Ow.
I was gonna say.
Ow.
It would have the Earth, Wind, and Fire shovel.
Right.
Yeah, okay. It would be like Love Solid Day. I can see that now.
Skip was great, though. Skip was brilliant cat. I used to play drums with Skip around town.
Really?
We used to play behind artists all the time. Yeah, me and Skip. So Skip was a cool guy. Great songwriter.
Wait, there was I have a question about like we had a cheap echo system, or like a reverb echo system in the mics thing, and like how that came out in 70
probably 7 to Love 77.
Okay, so I was 6. So the first song, I haven't heard it since I was a kid, but I remember the first song, someone's yelling the word showdown on the fade.
Oh yeah, that's my
showdown.
Brother.
Right.
That's my
and
brother,
so,
Billy.
And my father's speaker system, like all you have to do is test, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
Right.
And someone told me, okay, go over there and turn on the echo system, but it's nightclub. I'm like, sure, and just, I was permanently taken off of, I never told y'all that I got fired from sound. And he was like, no, you just work lights now. You're not working monitors or sounds anymore.
Showdown, that's funny.
Yeah, but with... you guys' presentation, which watching a lot of bands, I will say that maybe Heatwave is probably the only other band I knew that really put a lot of emphasis on their choreography and their acrobatics. I mean, Heat Wave.
Oh, they were crazy.
Yeah, they were literally
they were doing
like,
flips and backflips.
You ever see Heat Wave live or clips?
I've seen like a couple clips.
You ever see like Bring It On or like those cheerleading ESPN cheerleading squad things?
Oh, yeah.
Where they're standing on shoulders and
they
things
were doing
like
that?
Heat Wave was damn near doing like human pyramids. Like,
oh, wow.
But yeah. Playing at the same time, but still like Johnny Wilder's like
right.
On someone's shoulders and someone's on his shoulders.
Oh,
and
oh, wow.
Crazy. But you guys were like.
Well, our horn section was flashy. They did all kinds of steps.
Yeah, y'all were always, so together. With,
yeah.
So what was, in that period, when the wheels were turning, the hits were coming, were you guys like, okay, we got to have a presentation better than this group and that group, like.
Oh yeah, it was very competitive back then. The interesting thing was though that there was one guy that made all the damn uniforms, which people don't know. A guy named Bill Whitten. Bill Whitten made the Commodore's uniforms, LTD's uniforms, Earth, Wind, and Fire's uniforms. We all had those big tubes and stuff and all this.
Yeah, the mirrors on the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering.
Yeah, it was a guy named Bill Whitten, and you know, but yeah, it was you know. It was competitive back then, but it was a fun kind of competitiveness. You know, we would challenge each other. You know,
did you ever think like, okay, well, Parliament's cheating because they're using theatrics, and we need to do that. We need to levitate. Oh God, Earth, Wind, and Fire is using duck.
Oh
Henning,
yeah, they had right
duck Henning and all that stuff. So was there any discussion of? Because I know that in opening for the Jacksons and their affinity for. Explosives and all those things.
Right.
Like, was there ever the thought process like we now have to add on top of these songs to
right.
add these theatrical elements to our show?
I don't think we ever felt that. I think we were just happy to finally be getting a paycheck and not put it all into production. But you're right, because that Jackson tour was eye-opening for me. You know, that was. Actually, the year Michael came out with Off the Wall, that was his first solo record. So we used to open for them, and then they would come out and do theirs, and then he would go back and come back as a solo artist.
Right.
And it was a fascinating show. It was amazing. Just that whole, just traveling with them. I've never seen anybody that the fans went so crazy over as Michael. I mean, it was scary to watch it.
How did... For that particular tour, how did I'm thinking in terms of production, like as far as backline is concerned. Like right. Normally, if
we carried all of it back then, most of it.
Really?
Yeah.
So you got set up and did your loading and all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, no, we didn't. We had roadies, but I mean, we you know we weren't renting backline back then. You know.
Well, just even the point of like using an established act wouldn't want an opening act
right.
that had. You know, I would just think like LTD, damn, all those microphones, and then they got right. a sound check, use their soundboard, and then I got to wipe the board. There was no digital stuff back then.
Right.
So it was like, as big as their production was, then what space did that leave you guys, all 10 of you, to set up your instruments and your equipment and your...
Well, you know, the biggest thing was them setting up, because we went on first. So it was kind of easy for us. I mean, you know... Once we finished, then they had to set that whole stage up for them. But the thing, but they made it tough for us. They did make it tough for us. Because, I mean, we had to, you know, I always tell people, they're like, I do shows with people, and they're like, well, you got this banner, take this banner down. I'm like, dude, I sang shows with the Jackson sign literally hanging on top of my
head. On top of you.
I'm ducking, right? And these people, so, yeah. So it was challenging because, you know, they were the headlining act. And so... You know, they could leave most of their stuff up. So we had to play around it. So a lot of times we didn't even have that much room on stage. But we were an incredible live band.
I mean,
and they kicked us off that tour. They kicked us off. Before they went to L.A., they was like, you will not be opening for us in L.A. They kicked us off the tour. We did a handful of days. We did Madison Square Garden here. And but we used to light them groups up. Commodores, we used to light them up. Telling you, it was nobody wanted us in front of them.
Really?
We were a great live group, and you know, so That's how it was back in the day, man. You know, you had to bring it.
You said that a competition was really big back then. Who were some of the bands that you guys were afraid of? Or were you afraid of
it? You know, everybody was good back then. So, you know, we were on shows with the Commodores mainly. The big tour back then was LTD Commodores. We did maybe 2-3 years of that tour. And then we'd be on packages. So we were with the OJs a lot, Confunction. You know, we did some dates with Earth, Wind & Fire. So it was competition. But, you know, for most of the parts, we were never headlining most of those shows. We were somewhere in the middle. We opened for the Commodores. It was just us and the Commodores. And the Jacksons was just us and the Jacksons. But then we did a lot of those big places like the Dome in Atlanta. And we had, you know, the OJs, Confunction, LTD, Commodores. And we'd be somewhere in the middle. And we used to always talk shit. Now, my favorite, one of my
was
favorite
it, was
guys.
Was it Friendly Fire?
Yeah, it was Friendly Fire. Okay. Yeah. Because, you know, my favorite, one of my favorite guys of all time is Eddie LaVert. Mm-hmm. I thought he was probably one of the best entertainers I've ever seen. Because that dude brought it every single night. I knew there was not going to be one night that went by where he was not going to bring it. So we used to talk shit to each other. And he was like, well, I'm going to sing Love Ballad tonight. And I'm like, okay. I'm going to sing I'll Be Sweeter Tomorrow tonight. We used to, but it was friendly. It was friendly. You know, it didn't start getting ugly until... God, like the 90s, and them groups started going crazy. Well, it was shooting going on at sound checks.
My era.
It was all kind of wild stuff like, going on.
I always used to wonder how friendly it got because, you know, you listen to, Funkadelics, Let's Take It to the Stage. And it's like Slick and the Family Brick. And, you know,
They used to talk a lot of stuff.
So I was just wondering, you know, did anybody ever get offended? You know, was anybody.
I thought it was funny, actually. Yeah. It didn't offend me,
okay.
You know. I thought it was funny. They had names for us. They said we had a two on our funk.
Oh, wait, what?
LTD had a two on the funk. like we cut it twice. Right. That's pretty damn funny.
So I think the first time that we sort of communicated was when the New Edition biopic came on. Were you surprised at all that they covered Holding On in that, or did they ever tell you like that was our?
No, Johnny kept hinting to me, you know, when they were doing. He said, "Man, you're gonna like this. You're gonna like this." I said, "Really?" He said, "Oh yeah, man, we did it right." He said, "We did it right. You're gonna see." But I remember meeting them when they had first come out, and you know, Brooke, their manager, the choreographer, Brooke did everything.
Brooke, yeah,
you know he. They did a show and they opened up for me and he came. He said, man, I need you to come to the dressing room and talk to these kids. They're so wild, man. He said, they love you, man. They love Holding On. They love all your songs. So if you come and speak with them, man, it would mean a lot. So I went to the dressing room and talked to them and they was wild. Like you said, they was just kids, man. They was having fun. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the song they got their deal with, you know, Holding On. So
yeah, when I was watching it, I was just like, and I was more happy because normally in cases like that, they'll try to dumb down to the, you know, the lowest common denominator. And normally, like working a movie, music placement, usually the producer's like, well, why don't we pick a song that's more popular, da 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 da, whatever.
Right.
And so I knew that movie was serious when I was like, yo, they actually. And I called the music supervisor. I was like, how'd that even happen? He's like, yep, we wanted to keep authentic and real. And that's the song they always. Yeah,
that was the song.
Always rehearsed to.
They slicked it up a little bit with Jimmy and Terry. Put a little hardcore groove on it. It was funky. I was like, yeah. But yeah, no, they, and then, you know, I ran into Bobby at some function. And he was like, man. They gave you more play than they gave me in that movie. Played your song more than they played mine.
Were you shocked at all at the reception of how Stranger got embraced in the dancehall community at all? Or
Stranger, the song Stranger?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect it to be that kind of a song, you know. But it's
And I hate to ask this because I want to. I want to ask a sampling question and then open up the door like, wait, oh, well, I didn't know that.
It's been sampled a million times.
Oh, okay, you know about it.
A million times. That lick, if I got paid for every time someone sang that, la, na, 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 I'd be going to the bank.
Yeah, I was going to say,
everybody ripped that.
That has held down dancehall music for so long that I was like, yo, I really kind of hope, you know.
That's where that, you know. That copyright thing comes in. You know, you get four bars to, you know, you got to change it on the fourth bar and you're safe.
Wait, who did, I'm trying to figure out who initially did it. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, no, no, no.
R. Kelly. No, he was the big one.
He
was really.
But he, but no, it's the dancehall guy.
I know you're talking about, but I can't remember the name. I can't remember the name.
Because my very first gold record came from him as well.
Oh, really?
Well, he sampled "Who Am I?" Sim Sima. Who got the
pinch? Oh, God. So you guys are musicologists.
I know, but we're I'm failing today. We have to look it up now. Yeah. No, well, I was saying that my very first gold record for the longest was. The only gold record I can claim, not my own, was for Beanie Man.
Sample.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Your eventual exit from the group, going into your solo career, you said that it wasn't amicable. So you gave yourself like at least a year to...
Well, I had to sit out a year before I could even sign with the A&M because of this songwriter's agreement. Because they really wanted to sign me as a writer on the publishing side and as an artist. So they wanted the deal to run concurrently. And so I was tied up with them and they wouldn't give me a release. And they told me that if I gave them a piece of my contract, they'd give me a release. So there was some ugly stuff going on. So I said, I'll sit this year out.
Wait, so you were signed, you had to sign the LTD and with A&M? Like,
no, I had a songwriter's agreement signed with LTD.
Okay.
And it was another year on it.
Okay.
And so A&M Records wanted to sign me concurrently with a publishing deal and as an artist. And so they came to A&M and said, well, we'll make a deal. If he gives us a piece of this and a piece of that, we'll give it. And I'm like, I'm not giving up a piece of nothing no more. So I just sat a year out. So
is that why the Devotion and the Shine On record were so released in proximity? Because in my head, and you can't even find the Devotion album anymore on streaming services or anything like
that. Yeah, it's hard to find.
Was it just like, okay, let's get this out with and then that's it?
No, I don't think so. They you know, they put a little time into the record. It didn't affect that record.
Okay.
It affected their next record, though.
Right.
Because, you know, the company wasn't happy about what happened. Because they had their last record on A&M was After I Left, the song, but they had April Love on that song. And
yeah.
But that kind of affected their deal, you know, because they basically went back and said, this is a whole other thing now. They went over budget with that record. So the record company said, oh, well, okay, they called me and they said, okay, we got a wedge now. They're over budget, so maybe I can work a deal with them and we'll give them the rest of the money if they give you the release. So I said, cool. So they worked the deal.
It worked in your favor.
And no, but they didn't hold up to their end of the deal, LTD, which is why there was only one record left that they had.
Damn.
So
it could have been.
Hey,
man.
Great group, though.
I love
it. I mean, yeah, it's a great group.
So with your solo record, I mean, was it a feeling of relief finally, like, or was it fear? Like, okay, I'm here alone.
Yeah,
I'm responsible for everything. And
well, it was a little bit of both because I didn't have, now I'm out front. It was like, I got it now because my name was never out front of the group. It was always just LTD. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're on stage and you always feel the comfort of having 9 other people behind you. So now it's just me. And not ever having my name out there, I didn't know if people didn't know my name. They knew my voice. They didn't know my name. So the obstacle we had was to associate the name with the voice, which is why my first record was just called Jeffrey Osborne. Because back then, radio used to backlog everything and front log everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be, okay, this is Really Don't Need No Light by Jeffrey Osborne from the album Jeffrey Osborne. So they'd have to keep saying
my name.
So it kind of, yeah, it happened kind of quick. But George, you know, working with George was great too. It helped to have, I just felt solid. You know, when you have like a guy that is that musically incredibly solid doing your project, I felt good about that. I'm like, well, I know it's going to be musically, right?
So you personally chose him?
Yeah.
Or were there any other options? Like, did you?
Well, you know, the record company was really cool. They said, you know, we want to find the right person for you, you know. So I talked to a few other people, but when I met George, I was like sold on George, you know.
Okay.
Just, you know, and we had done shows with George, so I had met George before. But he was, man, what a guy. Talent.
Okay, I'm dying right now because I just Wikipedia'd his first solo record. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that Steve Ferrone was the drummer on that album.
And Steve Ferrone, and now this is what's funny. George didn't even know Steve Ferrone. But I had done gigs with...
How do you not know?
He didn't know Steve Ferrone because George was into more than Dougal Chancellors, you know, those kind of fusion kind of drummers more so. So,
right.
And I had been doing shows with AWB, you know, a lot of shows, and he was my favorite drummer. I used to sit there and I just was fascinated. He had the most incredible press roll I ever heard.
It's his favorite drummer too.
I'm like, how do you do that?
Yes! Yes!
So I was like, I told George, I said, man, I would love to have this drummer, Steve Ferrone. He said, I don't know, man. I don't know Steve. I said, man, I'm telling you. He said, well, he's in New York. We got to fly him in. We got to put him up. I said, it's going to be worth it, George. It's going to be worth it. He said, I am going to trust you on this.
Wait a minute. Now I have to listen to this entire record because, God, even the double hit at the end of On the Wings of Love.
Right.
Yo, wait till I tell my bandmates. That's Steve. Steve Ferrone is my idol and
really?
The reason why I drum.
Damn, that he's one of my idols, man.
Him
and Bernard Purdy.
Yeah.
Those are my boys.
His black and white kit that he used on the AWB tour, like
right.
His only drum kit.
Right.
He gave me that snare drum my first day of the Tonight Show.
Are you serious?
Yeah, like I was raised on AWB. When I saw him on Soul Train, I was like, that's what I want to do for a living. So he gave me that on my first day at the Tonight Show.
Yo, what an incredible dude,
Steve
man.
Steve Ferrone, drumming on the Wings of Love.
Yeah, he played on that.
Speaking of which,
we have that in common.
Yes. Now for the next 90 minutes. Sugar Steve.
Oh, I mean, are we at that?
Yes, we're there. I set you up for the alley-oop.
It feels ridiculous. I mean, this guy's telling us an actually, I mean.
No, don't be ashamed. Listen, Steve has, I've been waiting for you to tell this story to our listeners. We've been throughout the history of the show.
Right.
They've known that On the Wings of Love means something to Steve, but we never thoroughly explained.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but why? I mean, first of all,
you're going to feel silly telling
that
in front of.
No, I just got. I'm a Jewish person. I have 10 disclaimers I want to put first.
Don't do it. Look, Jeffrey, have you ever had someone just nerd out on you?
Yeah.
And it's been a little awkward. Well, 101 won't hurt you.
No. Just, it's not awkward at all. I've told the story literally 100 times in my life. So it's not awkward. It's awkward telling it to you, but.
Just pretend he's not here.
Yeah.
Steve, tell us about On the Wings of Love. Just talk to me and Bill.
I'm about to.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to tell it to Jeffrey, though, actually, if you don't mind.
All right. Well, I'm going to eat my oatmeal.
Okay. And I'm sure you've heard 1,001 stories about this song and people's experiences with this song.
Yeah.
Weddings, I'm sure, right. This, that, and the other thing. But for me, what is it, 1982 now? So I was 11 or 12 or something like that in 7th or 8th grade. And so junior high. And we had music. It was a music class. And one of the assignments, Mr. Gallo was the teacher. And the assignment was called a rollout, which was basically you choose a song and you do illustrations based on the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And then you go in front of the class, you play the song, and as the song plays, you roll out the scroll of illustrations as the lyrics go by. So that was my favorite song at the time. It was in the top 10 or whatever, and I was completely digging it. So I chose that song, and I worked for weeks on this rollout, and I had the markers and the crayons, and I went to town. I mean, it's these, you know, as the first verse starts and all the sunshine, I had, right. You know, everything was sun and love and wings and hearts and.
I'm having a hard time seeing this coming from you.
And you didn't. say this was junior high. I thought this was elementary.
No, there's just like 7th grade or something like that.
Okay, so, junior high. Okay,
right out of elementary school, but okay. whatever grade you're in when you're 11 or 12. So I did this. I mean, I have to say, I did a great job on this thing. Real proud of it, and went into school the day that we were presenting it, and sitting in the class, and Mr. Gallo says, "All right, well, the boys are going to go first," and so the first boy went up and he says, "All right, you know." My song is Black Sabbath, War Pigs, and proceeds to play War Pigs and rolls out this rollout. And next boy comes up and he says, "Yeah, this is my song is Van Halen, Running with the Devil." You know, does his thing. Next kid comes up. Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water. You see where this is going.
I see where this is going.
So next up, Stephen Mandel, come to the front of the class. By this point, I know that things have gone horribly awry for me already and are about to go much more horribly awry. Of course, with all due respect, to the greatness of your song. So I go up to the front of the class, heart's beating, everybody looking at me, put my cassette in, you know, in the boom box. Piano starts. and the intro, and then the first verse starts. I start rolling out my scroll. Here comes the sun. Here comes the hearts. Here comes the wings. And I see all the girls looking at me like falling in love. And I see all the dudes pointing and laughing and screaming.
Sorry, I had to. Okay, go.
It was, you know, it was clearly at that moment when I realized, you know, that I wasn't cool, I guess, according to. So I was essentially excommunicated for the next, I don't know, 6 years from the social scene of my junior high and then high school. I was beat up, mocked,
oh my God,
laughed at. Of course, now keep
stomp, beat up, and whooped.
But here's the end, or the punchline rather, which is the joke was on them because I got an A+, and it took a few years to recover from that socially, but. Wow. I never turned my back on the song though. I never said that song.
If every time you heard it, you kind of went into a
the opposite. Man.
No,
the opposite.
He went deep into which actually leads me to my next question. Because the song got so much traction on MR, which is
I don't know what that stands for.
What is it?
Middle of the Road.
MOR.
Yeah. So. At least in 82, there's a pattern that I noticed of 70s X, 70 soul X that go solo,
right.
Or, sort of go to a promised land. Like I never thought it was a thing of, okay, what do I have to do to survive or justify my record deal? And I never, you know, and I've read some of that stuff in Jet Magazine, like going pop or whatever, or crossing over. But, you know, between Kool and the Gang, the Pointer Sisters, Lionel, Michael Jackson,
right?
Whatever. I mean, there's this migration into a new uncharted smooth black pop territory. Mm-hmm. That you're kind of planting your flag and not occupying. I mean, at the time with On the Wings of Love, did you feel as though, okay, this might have the potential to be something more than it was? Or to you, it was just like, oh, got another ballot here. This is it.
No, I think, you know, On the Wings of Love to me was a chance to showcase another side of myself.
Okay.
That I hadn't really had that opportunity with LTD. Because LTD, most of the ballots were straight up R&B ballots. Mm-hmm. So this was the first chance I got it. Because I always felt, you know, I mean, I want to be able to sing everything. Well, no matter what it is, I want to be able to sing that. And I never really got the closest thing we came to it was the year before was Shine On, mm-hmm. which was, again, written with Richard Kerr, who
right.
was one of those, you know, big songwriters back then. And that didn't do as well as the R&B records on that record. I mean, the R&B songs, like Where Did We Go Wrong, those were bigger than Shine On. But I just felt like it was a nice departure and still trying to keep the record so that it was, you know, it had an R&B flavor to it. I didn't want to leave the R&B roots, but I did want something that might go across. It was weird back in the 70s. I mean, it was a time we couldn't put our faces on the record covers.
Yeah.
You know, you remember that. Mm-hmm. You know, the rack jobbers, they wouldn't rack it. And so it was weird. And we didn't even get a chance to have the pop department work our records at A&M Records. They never even worked our records. Back in Love just crossed over on its own.
Really?
They didn't know what happened. They looked up and it was on the pop charts.
Like whoops.
Oh, okay. So then now they want to take credit for it.
Right.
Like, yeah, right. You did nothing. So yeah. So I kind of made, you know, it was one of those songs when I heard it, I was like, I wrote it with this guy, a piano player. And when he played it for me, I was like, I like that. That's kind of showcases another side. So
well now I'm realizing that you had every monster on this album. Between
well,
Paul
were some
Jackson
people
and
on there and yeah.
Ernie Watts had,
and
Larry Graham
did a yeah.
Michael Cimbello, Louis Johnson,
yeah. Mike Cimbello,
and Ellison, Hawk,
Hawk Walensky. I wrote a couple of songs.
Yeah, really don't need no light.
Yeah,
yeah. So
no, he had some people on that record. Yeah.
So at the time, were you just like a kid in a candy store? Like I want the best of the best to work on this record. And
well, I was. I mean, but you know, it wasn't just me. It was George. You know. George was like, yeah, we got
getting
have
George
this guy.
Means that yeah, he has the exactly, connections to get
exactly. Okay. And a lot of those people had worked with George before, with the exception of Ferroni, you know. And I don't know if Mike Cimbello had worked with him before, but Mike was incredible dude, man. Mike could play, and Mike could sing too. Mike was talented.
Yeah, you know, this is blowing my mind that I didn't realize that Ferone's on all these records.
So Peter Schless.
Peter Schless, yeah, I wrote the song with Peter Schless. And when it's funny, I played it for George, and he was playing it real fast, you know. George said, nah, I ain't hearing that.
Really?
I'm like, George, I'm going to slow it down. You know, I'm going to get this melody's going to be right. I'm going to write these incredible lyrics. You're gonna really have to turn my head on this one. So I finally brought it into him. He said, "Oh, okay, yeah, I like that."
And that was the first single on this record.
No, Really Don't Need No Light was the first single.
Even when queuing up his singles for it, for some reason, I Really Don't Need No Light and Don't You Get So Mad in my head, they're
the same song.
Yeah. And then I realized, like, oh, wait a minute. They are two different songs.
They're two different songs, but yeah, they got that same vibe. And they were written by totally different people, which is interesting, you know.
I know that Barry Mann and Cynthia, they wrote
We're Going Our Way. Yeah.
In the songwriters period of the 80s, and was it just that you go to a publishing house and they give you a slew of cassettes to listen to and you...
Yeah, that's basically...
How do you...
Yeah, generally back then, you know, all these publishing companies, they kind of put the word out. You know, when an artist is getting ready to do a record, you put the word out and then you start getting stuff submitted, you know, from all the other different publishing companies. And that's basically how it worked. And but with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, they actually came to me and said they had a song that they thought would be good for me. And I mean, you know, here's a duo that had probably number one hit records going as far back as, you know, the Leader of the Pack and
yeah.
all that stuff. I mean, you know, every year they had a number one record. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I was like, I'm sure not going to turn this down. So, yeah, so it was great getting a song from them. And that's an intricate kind of a song. I mean.
So they tailor-made it just for you?
I don't know if they tailor-made it for me. I think that they had written this song and they thought that it would be good for me. It's not like I went to them in front and said, write me a song. You know, they came in with the song and I was like, yeah, this is a nice piece of work. Yeah.
I could tell that A&M was really behind the Baby Stay With Me Tonight because the commercials.
Funny. That's funny though, because A&M told me I should go back and sing that song again. I sang it too low.
What?
I'm telling you, this stories when you think. Yeah, they told me, this ain't right. You got to go back and sing it. It's too low. Your voice is too low. I'm like, too low? That's my voice.
Who was your A&R on this project?
Back then? I'm trying to think. Well, Charlie Minor was the pop A&R guy. I think it was this guy named Barry. I can't think of his last name. It was so long ago.
Really?
Yeah, but they basically told me, I think you missed it, and you should go back and re-sing it. And I'm like, I'm not going to go back and re-sing this. This is how it's supposed to be.
That's weird because...
What do you want me to do now? Sing it in the other octave in a falsetto?
The commercial spots that they had for the album almost made it almost like James Bondish, like Osborne. Osborne. Like the and the logo and all that stuff. Like, right. They showed a lot during like Soul Train and Solid Gold. So
that was Raymond Jones who... actually wrote that song, and it was kind of all of his vision. You know, he came in, he wanted Alfonso Johnson to play bass. I mean, he kind of had it scoped out.
That's who played bass. Okay.
Yeah, Alfonso Johnson. And you know, Raymond was a talented guy. You know, he was with Chic all those years, and real talented guy. There was a different song for that period. Because it's funny because I hear that song now on the radio and it kind of almost sounds like what's going on today. It's actually sounds fresher than anything else I've done. And still, it's an 80s song.
Yeah, it's stood the test of time.
Yeah, it had all the gimmicks. And that was, you know, Hawk Wilinski was the gimmick guy, too.
Really?
Oh, that guy would come in. He was the first person I ever seen come in with that Linn drum machine. And sequence Plain Love was completely sequenced, and George was freaking out. George was like,
Hawk Walensky did Plain Love?
Yeah, he wrote it.
that's my shit.
Yeah, he was. George was like, George was not into that. He was like, I don't know, man. I don't know about this sequence stuff, man.
You serious?
Yeah. He wasn't crazy about just the way it was laid out. But I mean, as we got into it, he was like, okay, all right, I see what he's going after. But you know, there was like syndromes on there and was some weird
stuff. Yeah, and even the 12-inch mix of it. Like,
the 12-inch was, that's the only 12-inch mix that I liked of any song that was ever mixed of mine. I hate all the mixes.
Yes.
That's the only one I like.
Even to this day, I DJ the 12-inch mix of it. it works like gangbusters.
That was the number one dance song in New York when it was out.
Yes, it was. Yeah. That was like, yeah. That was a B-boy classic. Mm-hmm. It had a break in the middle and all that stuff.
When I come to New York to do shows, I have to do Plain Love. And I don't do it most of the time, but I have to do it here.
I was going to, okay, so eventually one of these days, you know, we're going to have you sit in on the Tonight Show.
Right.
We've been waiting for this moment forever, and we were kind of on our group chat and like, okay, what are the six of them? What do we make them do? What do we make it do? And
so, you know, one slot's filled. Yes, right here.
Yes, we know. But this
that's
morning,
a,
I was like,
beast of a song to play.
It's funny you say that.
That's a keyboard nightmare.
But in my head, I was like, yo, will he? Because in my head, like, even the deep cuts, like Soweto,
right?
Plain Love, like all. I was just like, he probably don't do that no more. He'll just.
I do it. It just depends. But I've been doing it a lot lately, actually, Plain Love.
What?
Yeah. I've been doing it a lot lately.
Okay.
I have a question about a song, real quick.
Yeah.
Was I Just Want to Be Your Friend ever released on an album?
It was on that soundtrack album.
There was a soundtrack?
It was on the soundtrack.
Okay, I can't find that soundtrack anywhere.
What is it on?
The Toy.
The Toy.
With Richard Pryor.
Yeah, it was on the Toy.
It was a theme song.
How do you even know that song?
Oh, man, I love The Toy.
Nobody even knows that song exists.
The Toy is one of my favorite movies ever. So, of course, I've seen the intro like a billion times, and it opens the movie. So
it does. It's so funny. I mean, my wife, you know, every now and then, that movie will come on and she'll care. I can't believe that she's singing this song.
I used to love that song. Come on.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You worked with... with Rod Temperton, how did you get? I know that he opened the.
I
got to look up the emotional record.
It wasn't.
We Belong to Love.
We Belong to Love was the song. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that Rod Temperton did that one. Did he collaborate with you directly, or was it just like?
No, he wrote it. I was trying to collaborate with him, but you know, Rod's a different kind of guy. Yeah. Rod's like, okay, all right, well, mate, we'll try to make this work.
He didn't pull any.
And then
teeth
he calls me and says, "Well, I got the song." Okay.
Did he pull his teeth as he did it?
Yeah, he's Rod.
No, he always.
Right, yeah. That's Rod. Right.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I hate the fact that I'm seeing this in real time. Hamish Stewart co-wrote.
Soweto?
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Really?
Yeah. Hamish
brought the song to me. I was like, wow, I like this song.
Really?
Yeah. I know. It's kind of weird, isn't it? When you think about Hamish,
how did I not
you think
know
about that?
That
song.
Yeah. Like, so how
I can't
that
believe
even...
there's something you don't know because, damn, you know every damn thing. You know more about me than I do.
No, I don't. I'm just saying that. You know what it is? I have most of your discography on cassette.
Right.
A lot of those credits aren't in the cassette.
Exactly. Oh, they're so tiny you can't
read
it.
Yeah, I didn't have it in... No, if it was on record, if I had the records, actual albums...
No, the writing's really fucking small on here, too.
No, but I mean, dude, I would have...
That's a lot bigger than anything you're going to get today, though.
If you get anything.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Whose decision or request or... desire was it to have Brian May from Queen on Stay With Me Tonight?
That was actually my manager, Jack Nelson, who used to manage Queen.
Oh, wow.
And
he did the guitar solo?
He did the guitar solo on Stay With Me Tonight, yeah.
Okay.
So he said, well, maybe I can talk Brian into doing it. I said, really? That would be really good if Brian came in and did it. And he came in and did it. Great guy.
So were you a Queen fan at
I knew a lot of their stuff. I wasn't like a big Queen fan, but I knew a lot of their material. And I was shocked at some of the songs that Brian May wrote. I mean, I didn't know he wrote We Will Rock You. Mm-hmm. That's like in every stadium across the country. Dude's incredible.
I can't read. Who played bass on Stay With Me Tonight?
Alfonso Johnson.
Oh, okay. Sorry you said that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So with You Should Be Mine... which, of course, the magic's in the woo-woo-woo ad-libs. Mm. I mean, how is that presented to you in a way where you're like, okay, this will work? Or because the thing is like hearing you sing, and I'm like, right. Oh, yeah, hell yeah, that shit. But I can't imagine you hearing the demo
right,
and saying like, yep, this is going to work for me. Like, how did...
I didn't really know until I sang it. And once I sang it, I liked it. And back then, you know, you bring everything home and you bring it home and you put it on in the house, you know, and you listen.
House tested.
And my 3-year-old daughter, she's the one that confirmed it. I mean, she barely can talk and she's like, Daddy, what? That woo-woo song is so good. I'm like, what? I said, it's not called the woo-woo song. It's called You Should Be Mine. She said, nope, that's the woo-woo song.
I bet you every black person you ever met says
the woo-woo song.
Can you woo-woo-woo? That's...
Everyone. I mean, they'll just yell it out from somewhere. But yeah, that was a huge song, man. I became the woo-woo man all of a sudden. I was like, what?
Damn. You did. And why did you and Duke stop working together after the emotional album?
That was a record company kind of decision. They felt that we got there, but we didn't get where they thought I should be. And they thought Richard Perry was the hottest thing out right then. So it was all for good reasons, but it kind of broke up a really good relationship that I had with George. And so I was kind of reluctant. And then it turned out so bad. I was like, wow, that was not good. But yeah, it was kind of them. They came to me and they said, well, you know, these guys are hot, man. They got all these hit records and, you know, Richard is great at finding good songs and this and that. And so, you know, I gave it a shot. And
in their mind, did they say like, okay, well, you should be in Lionel territory now? Or like where was their point of satisfaction?
I think they felt that I should have been, that I could reach another plateau in their mind, you know. And I have to credit them with by saying, you know, they were looking out, you know, trying to do the best that they thought was in my interest. And I was kind of curious about it because I'm like, wow, these guys do have, this Richard Perry does have a serious track record of hits. And he brought in the big people, the Diane Warrens and all them. And, you know, the only thing that worked off that record was the woo-woo song.
Right. Well, I still dug Soweto.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, oh, Soweto was great too. It was a couple of good songs on there, but, you know, for the most part, it didn't, the relationship didn't work out with me and Richard.
Was it just, like, because I often wonder when you have a mega producer of that level, and I guess he did the breakout record with Pointer Sisters, right?
Yeah.
So when you have a mega producer that is probably often in demand, it's probably paint by numbers. If he's an industry, like, okay, I got you this week, and then I got
right,
there
exactly.
that week, and then.
Right.
So do you feel, as at least with the chemistry between you and George, was that you guys sat down and took time to socialize with
right.
each other and got to know?
Well, and on top of that, we were really good friends, you know. So we had a really good, relaxed relationship, you know. And you come into Richard, and it's more of a hyper kind of thing where, you know, he's in, and he was never satisfied with anything. So that was confusing me. I'm like, how could someone have all this success and he's never satisfied?
He,
you know, he would have, you know, back then you had your master 24 track and he would have like five slaves. I'm like, dude, when are you going to put all these up?
Right. You know?
So it was an interesting process working with Richard. And we thought it would actually, you know, just lead to more and more success, basically.
You made a move to Arista for...
Yeah, I did. That was an interesting move, too.
Was it Clive selling you the dream of, I can make this happen?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Because I actually was torn between Clive and Motown. Because Berry Gordy made a big pitch for me.
Wait, in 1990?
Yeah, but Motown wasn't really smoking hot then. Yeah.
Okay.
It was on the downside at that point. And Clive did his number. He offered, you know, me the, you know.
The right number.
Right, yeah. But then we clashed, me and Clive, kind of clashed because he doesn't like a strong personality. He likes somebody that's just going to do whatever he says. And, you know, I didn't have a problem as long as it was right. But then, you know, this is a guy that wants a saxophone solo on every record. There's going to be no other solo.
I see you and Kenny.
Yeah, it's got to be saxophone.
Soprano.
On every record. Take that off. Put a saxophone on. That's exactly right.
Sorry.
So we had a.
That's the Arista. That's the Arista sax. Like. Sorry.
The Arista sax.
I mean, if you think about right. it, it's right. that Jeff Lorber kind of.
It's the Kenny G thing for sure. Yeah, so we, you know, the first record, I had a great time with the Barry Eastman.
Okay.
He did basically the whole record. So I came back here to New York and worked with Barry. And I love Barry. He was a great guy to work with. But I don't think really Clive went after that record. I mean, Only Human was a hit. And then he kind of like fell off after that. By going after him. He thought If My Brother's in Trouble was a hit, and he kind of pushed that song on me.
Okay.
It wasn't a song that I selected, and that's another way you run into problems with Clive. He's so involved, and he wants to basically tell you what you should have on your record and pick your songs. So I had a hard time with that because, you know, I never had anybody telling me, well, you need to do this song, no, take that off, put this song on, do that. And so we kind of clashed heads, and I think my personality was a little too strong.
He doesn't
Clive. He doesn't like confrontation.
And does he give you at least the warning in the beginning, like, look, like, just let me drive the car, and I swear we'll get you to. I've heard the pitch. Well, I've heard the Clive pitch before. Like, I'll take you to places.
Exactly. He gave me that whole pitch, and then he, you know, he makes it sound right, you know. You don't realize you're going to go into a situation where, like my second record after Only Human, was 3 years before he could decide on what songs I was supposed to sing. So at that point, it got crazy, and so we worked on an agreement to get a release. So I only did one record with Arista.
Okay. Was, especially in the late 80s and early 90s, was the onslaught of New Jack Swing and what was happening with traditional R&B, was that troublesome for you at the time? Like, well, I'm not going to have to do the Running Man now in these videos.
Pull James Ingram. Like, yeah. Right. Get the Teddy Riley record.
Oh, that's right.
James Ingram did a Teddy Riley record.
Right. It's real.
Yeah.
Oh, that what? Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, I just never gave into that. It was all around me, and it was temptation. Maybe I should go this way, but I kind of said, I'm just going to try to stay doing what I do. You know, I mean, I think what happens with veteran artists is that, you know, you get to a point where there's always something new coming in. There's always a new flavor, especially with R&B and black audiences. They're on to the next hip thing all the time. So if you don't keep up, you kind of get pushed back. And then radio does the same thing. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, if it doesn't fit this format, mm-hmm. you're not going to get played. And they can't appreciate, you know, what you have to offer. Although they play your old stuff, they won't play the stuff you know. And so then there's the sellout point. Well, you know, do you do this? And then they say you're selling out. So it's a kind of a catch-22 as you get longer and longer into your career. It becomes a challenge. It's a demographic battle. You know, you're fighting for the people that actually go out and buy the records, which are the younger crowd. And it happens in every entertainer's life. I see people getting all my favorite singers got phased out when I was hot. You know, they were like still doing their thing, but radio wasn't embracing it and they didn't want to flip over to do this. And so I guess it's a natural process of evolution. The only person I've seen weather the whole damn storm is damn Tony Bennett. I can't figure him out. Jesus Christ. This guy is like 97.
He won't go nowhere.
Yeah.
He ain't going nowhere. He'll still be
and
here.
Still singing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still sounds pretty good.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Touring wise, what are your favorite territories?
Well, you know, I think here in the U.S., you know, there's always markets that you like to come to. You know, New York is one. They're tough markets. New York's a tough market.
Is it? Yeah.
Well, you better
even
be,
now.
You better be good in New York, or they'll let you know it. Yeah.
Even now.
I think so. Well, I'm not relevant to what's
happening. Jeffrey Osborne released 14 instant classics like back at.
But yeah, but you still better be good when you go out there to do them.
Oh, you can't phone it in from home?
No.
Oh, okay.
You know, you got New York.
You better do all the Mad Libs right at the end of Love Ballad or else they're going to be like, wait, mama, you missed one.
Oh. That's funny. But yeah, I mean, you know, these are, to me, New York, Philly, D.C., those are the markets that actually break you. You know, the West Coast markets, so they kind of follow suit. But these are the tough markets. So I like New York. I like Philly. I like D.C. And then my favorite place is New Orleans because New Orleans is just crazy, man. They just love everything down there.
Yeah.
They love
it. They drink 24/7, so the party's already started.
Yeah, but
What about outside of the United States? Like, where is a market?
You know,
that's
I like
Japan
the islands.
Or, okay,
I love the islands.
Okay,
you know, I just have a fun time there. I like the people. I feel like I'm right at home, and they've supported me forever there. I mean, Shine On is like the national anthem in Jamaica.
Exactly.
It's like what? Yeah. Nowhere else in the world, Shine On national anthem.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, you know, because I don't do a lot abroad. You know, I've done Europe, but not a lot of Europe, you know. And I'm just getting calls from Sweden. Like, mm-hmm. We want you over here in Sweden. I've never been to Sweden. So there's places I've never performed. A lot of places I've never performed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You got to do it. Wait, where do you reside now?
I live in L.A.
Okay.
I've been in L.A. since 1970, so... You know, I left with LTD back in 1970.
So since that, wait, you never told us at the beginning. Did you guys ever recover that trailer that went over the mountainside?
We did. We beat up some of our equipment. You know, but we recovered it and got it back up the mountain there and put it back on, hitched it, and went on our way to L.A.
I thought you guys were just like, oh, well, there's that.
No.
That's that.
No, we got it back. You know, we had to get it back. We were broke-ass people. We were like, we better get this equipment.
So you just released Worth It All.
Right.
Who did you work with on that record?
I worked with me, and that's it. I mean, really, I wrote everything and I produced everything on the record. So
cool.
It's probably the first record that I wrote everything on. I have one song that I actually wrote with my son, and it's interesting. He's a junior, never was into music, went to school to play basketball, came home from college and told me he raps now. I'm like, what?
Really?
I raised your ass and I never heard you rap once. Well, now, you know, I've been in the dorm with my friends and, you know, we all started rapping and so I'm into rap. So he's doing his thing now. He's, you know, rapping and writing. He's now writing music and he's a great engineer. He does my sound, live sound now.
Okay.
My sound engineer took him under his wing and he taught him well, because now when my engineer can't do it, he does my house and he's really good at it.
Oh, okay.
So I figured he hears different than I do. I'm like, okay, so give me a track.
Side note, that's also how I broke the news to my own dad that I was starting the Roots.
Really?
I was like, oh, by the way.
It was on your second album though, right?
Well, yeah, and he saw in the newspaper, what is this? I was like, really? Oh, I, little project with that hoodlum Tariq. Yeah, it's like, it took my second album for me to break that news to my dad. He wanted me in Juilliard and whatever.
Right.
I just have to say that this is amazing. Now, I'm still salty that I let a Steve Rome project go on for so long that I never knew about.
I just saw him, too.
Oh, man.
I did a show in L.A., one of the wineries in Temecula, and he was on the gig playing with Mindy Hebert. I'm like, what?
Oh, okay. At least he's still gigging. Because after
Tom Petty. He had just left Tom Petty.
Yeah, yeah. The Tom Petty thing.
At the time. So, yeah. Well, Steve always has the best gigs.
Yes, he does.
He always has the best gigs.
He does.
But he's still my favorite drummer, man.
Yep.
And then I saw Bernard Purdy at one of my shows in Houston. And that just lit me up. I love that dude.
Do you still play?
I mean, the Rocksteady song, that was it. He revolutionized all that.
Right.
No, I don't play. I haven't played since 1970. I'm going to say when Love Ballad became a hit, I was 75. The record company came to me and said, you have got to get up from behind the drums, because I used to play and sing all the time. They said, you know, this song is a hit with the ladies. They can't see you with four horn players standing in front of you. Got to get up. I didn't even know what to do with my hands. I was so used to singing and playing. So they got me this guy that was the president of a theater at the LA Community College, and he came in and he kind of worked with me and showed me how to kind of open up and, you know,
project.
And from that point on, I played on the next couple of records, but I never got a chance to really sit down and play, and my career kind of took off. And it's one of those instruments that is really touch sensitive. I mean, if you don't do it, I mean, I can sit down and play a groove, but when I start trying to get around it.
So never in concert were you like
I did at one point. I used to play in the show, but I don't anymore. And my band is, they've been on me to, you need to get back. You need to play at the show, man. But I got a shed. I mean, I got to sit down and not at the shed.
You got a shed.
3 months before I would even attempt.
Man, it's like riding a bike.
No, it ain't.
Okay.
I mean, playing the groove is like riding a bike.
Right,
but when
right.
you start getting around.
You got to do fills.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm hearing you. Oh, so. But, you know, I might get back into it. I just need to take the time out and sit down and do it, because it was it was kind of what got me into this business, really.
Awesome.
It opened up the doors for me.
Well, we thank you for it. Steve, any other things you...
Nah, man. I'm good.
Steve kind of opened up a lot.
Yeah, yo, man.
That was really therapeutic, good. Steve.
It was.
My wings feel good right now.
You feel good right now.
Well, Mr. Osborne, we thank you so much.
Oh, man, it's been a pleasure,
hopefully,
man.
One day you'll come on the Tonight Show and sit in with the group. Maybe we'll work together one day. Who
that
knows?
That would be great, man.
Yes.
I got to get you guys to come down to my, you know, I have a celebrity golf tournament.
I've been trying to get you.
It's in July this year, the 29th, 30th, and 31st.
The Jeffrey Osborne Celebrity golf Tournament.
It's an incredible tournament, man. And I have all the old school singers come. Smokey comes, OJ's come, Johnny Gill comes, Philip Bailey comes. And it's more than just a tournament because we jam.
Okay.
You know, and then, you know, Magic Johnson hosted for me every year. So I got Sugar Ray Leonard. I got the top athletes along with the best entertainers, and we just party, man. It's a 3-day party, man. It's incredible. It's at Foxwoods now.
I gotta come.
So it's at the casino, so everybody loves that. You know.
We thank you very much for coming on the show on behalf of Sugar Steve and Boss Bill, and I'm Pay Bill and Fonticolo and Laia, who are not here.
Suckers.
Yeah, suckers. Y'all missed the classic. Anyway, this is Questlove, Questlove Supreme. We will see you on the next go round. Thank you.
All right, man. My pleasure. Right.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.